you will never end pregnancy more nutrient replete than you started pregnancy, right? You're always, always siphoning off from the bank account. You're broke. You're nutritionally broke by the time you have the baby. And then breastfeeding, I mean, speaking of vitamin A, like needs for vitamin A almost double when you're nursing. And that's not talked about either. You need the vitamin A for all of these changes to happen in your breasts to allow you to produce sufficient amounts of breast milk. People don't talk about that, but that's a requirement.
This is the Gutsy Health Podcast, your go-to destination for uncomplicated, practical, and affordable tools for your wellness education with Jeanique Rover. Are you ready to become a self-healing champion? Let's go.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Gutsy Health Podcast. I have on the show today, Lily Nichols. She is a registered dietitian and nutritionist. She's a certified diabetes educator, researcher, and author with a passion for evidence-based nutrition. Her work is known for being research-focused, thorough, and sensible. And she is the founder of the Institute for Prenatal Nutrition, co-founder of the Women's Health Nutrition Academy, and the author of three books, which are Real Food for Fertility, Real Food for Pregnancy, and Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. And as many of you know, I just had a baby, and so I've been focusing a lot on pregnancy for people. And some of my posts have featured supplements for pregnancy. And I'm very passionate about it because obviously that's literally my life. And I just told Lily before we started recording, I'm like, hey, I'm wearing my baby right now and he might wake up and I'll just have to breastfeed him, but just keep talking. So I'm glad you're very comfortable with that, Lily. Welcome to the podcast. Everyone is going to be really excited. Everyone that's trying to fall pregnant, everyone that's currently pregnant and postpartum, there's so much information out there. And I think what is frustrating about the world that we live in is that there's so much information, but a lot of it is bad. And so trying to find the diamonds in the rough that actually are research-based and very thorough and sensible, it's hard to find because everyone's an expert. And so welcome to the podcast. I would love to hear your story of like how you got into this before we launch into our questions.
Sure, absolutely. Nothing throws me off with a baby nursing. I mean, I have two kids of my own. They're older now, no longer nursing, but I remember that stage quite well. I mean, my career as a dietitian really has worked in the prenatal women of childbearing age stage pretty much exclusively. So after I completed my formal training, I worked with the California Diabetes and Pregnancy Program on gestational diabetes policy for the state of California. I worked in clinical practice for many years, doing quite a bit of high-risk pregnancy, so nutrition for gestational diabetes, preeclampsia, and whatnot in a clinical setting, as well as my private practice. And then over time, that's kind of like snowballed into all the things that I'm doing now. With gestational diabetes, for example, I became pretty frustrated that a lot of the advice we were told to give clients actually did not really improve their blood sugar levels much and sometimes actually made them worse. And that was what prompted me to write my first book, Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. And then from there, it was like, hey, do you have information on general prenatal nutrition? And like, just read the gestational diabetes book. Like, you know, you do a lot of the same things, just don't stress about your blood sugar as much. But I decided to write Real Food for Pregnancy when my firstborn was 10 months old. And I had just like navigated that whole system and found it so frustrating how little attention is given to preventing pregnancy complications or like optimizing your nutrition. And everything feels very much like they're just looking for problems as they come instead of trying to be proactive ahead of time. Not to mention the advice you get, if any, is like, so bad. You know, you get like a list of foods to avoid and it's like, great. And that's not even evidence-based. So Real Food for Pregnancy was really born from that, just kind of setting the record straight on all sorts of outdated guidance we're given that really were 20, 30 years behind on updating those recommendations. Now, my forthcoming book, it'll be out by the time this is out, is on fertility, because likewise, a lot of the information we're given about eating to optimize our health preconception is really not that great quality. So I tend to take a deep dive into the literature, see like where the gaps are in the guidelines, how they're set, how we can do better, and put it in a format that's hopefully digestible for the general public.
I'm so glad you've mentioned that because it's interesting. My co-host, her name is Gina Warfel. She's a dietitian, and then she got a master's in human health. And when I first met her, I was like, oh, you're a dietitian. And she's like, no, I'm one of the good ones. Because unfortunately, there is kind of like this battle of like egos, I feel like, in the health world of dietitians versus nutritionists. And because dietitians have their dietetics degree, like the information they're given is superior. But what you're saying is like, it's 20 to 30 years behind. And the information that you were giving people wasn't even helpful, which is again, why it's so important to do research and to recognize like there's way more than what our main educational institutions give us. And that's basically was your experience where you're like, the information that I was taught to tell people didn't even help people and was behind. And so you dove deep into the research. I don't even want to use like, you're one of the good guys. I hate that because that's so divisive, right? But you realize like there was a deficit. Like what you were taught wasn't enough. And so you had to go off on your own and be like, there's more here and we're missing it. And it's okay to dive deep into this research and think outside the box. And so that's what you've created, correct?
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think I don't want to completely discount the value of like a traditional dietetics education because I think it's like, it's great to have the science background. I mean, if you use your degree to the point that you're going to really get into the research, which is what I chose to do, and just getting a good like solid base on your like biology and biochemistry and all of that, that's valuable. And it's important to kind of understand sort of the paradigm our healthcare system is in, which you have to do when you do your dietetic internship. You work in conventional healthcare. I think that really illuminates some of the challenges we just face in that system as a whole and why it's like so broken. But if you don't expand your education beyond the confines of that box, that's, I think, where we run into problems. And sadly, like the way they kind of present the whole dietitian career is that you are the nutrition expert, and they kind of like intentionally really build up people's egos and create this us against them situation instead of being more collaborative. Sorry, but like if the only area we're going to be practicing is like super conventional dietetics, then yeah, we're going to be like left in the dust by other health professionals and nutritionists who have advanced degrees and are really into looking deeper than just like, here's the guidelines, follow them, you know? And again, not every dietitian falls into that box, but many do. And I think it's given the general public kind of a bad taste about our profession. So I do the same where I'm like, no, I'm a real food dietitian. Like, you know, I try to like, I'm proud of the credential, but it also is a liability at the same time because people have certain assumptions on your knowledge and skill set.
And I think a lot more dietitians are starting to kind of follow the way of which you're going, which is like, there's a deficit here.
Oh, absolutely. It is expanded. Like the last 20 years has been crazy being in this career field. I mean, so many student dietitians are like pushing back against guidelines. I'm like, yes, they're being kind of the squeaky wheel, which is what we need.
She also mentioned, and then let's get into the topic, but she also mentioned when she went to like a dietetics convention, the sponsors were like Coca-Cola and like soda and processed food companies and whatnot. And she's like, something's not feeling right here. Like there's something's being bought and paid for by the wrong companies. And if we're supposed to talk about health, like soda companies are backing us, like there's a disconnect. So anyways, I think people are waking up because the research is there. Research is so accessible. And so you're not up to date with the research if you don't think that food matters, right? Like macros in, macros out. It doesn't work anymore. Anyways, all right. I want to kind of start from the beginning of a woman's fertility journey, right? Women, if we are trying to fall pregnant, what should we start asking ourselves? What should we start thinking about? And what should we start eating and supplementing or being aware of?
I think we really have to think of the whole fertility conversation beyond just the singular goal of getting pregnant. And think about our long-term health. So our, not just if you can get pregnant, but if you can actually sustain a healthy pregnancy, have like a, dare I say, enjoyable, not super problematic and complication-ridden pregnancy, how can we optimize our health? This goes for our partner too, for optimal egg and sperm quality, so that you have the best chances of conception taking place and that embryo properly implanting and growing and the placenta properly like forming in those early weeks of pregnancy, because that really sets the trajectory for just a healthier outcome all around. So I think we need to look beyond just the get pregnant, because we have all sorts of means that you can go to with, especially with artificial reproductive technology nowadays. A lot of people feel like their fertility is not really in their control, but if anything goes wrong, you'll just go to ART, you'll get IVF or something like that. And even outcomes from that, if that becomes necessary, are better when you're coming into it with solid nutrition stores.
I always compare it to like a car, you know, like you want the highest quality car, the highest quality oil, the best tires, the best leather seats, because when you spill food on those seats, like they'll clean really easily versus like the cheap product. Like you want a high quality car, which will last you forever and go places you never thought you would go. And the body is the exact same, where you want high quality fuel because you want really healthy cells and cellular replication and DNA replication and all the things, right?
Absolutely. And so one of the ways in which we can kind of monitor whether or not our body is nourished enough to fall pregnant is to look at our menstrual cycle and see what's going on with it. So are you tracking your signs of ovulation, for example? Are you confirming that you've ovulated every cycle? Is your cycle relatively consistent in length? Is there even like a sufficient amount of blood flow like during your cycle? Because that, you know, every time you have your period, your body is shedding your endometrium, like the lining of your uterus. That is actually the first place that an embryo is going to implant. And that is what nutritionally sustains it until the placenta is fully formed. Of course, the placenta needs to form and like it literally invades the endometrium. So you need a really strong base for that to happen. And that is reflected in, dare I say, like the strength of your menstrual cycle. So are you, you know, of course, there could be such a thing as too much bleeding, but are you having the typical 3, 4, 5 days of bleeding with like maybe a heavy day or two in there? That's often an indication that yes, your endometrium is healthy enough for this process. Paying attention to that, I think, is really helpful as well. And actually in Real Food for Fertility, we have a whole, the book is co-authored, right, by myself and my friend who's a fertility awareness educator. So we do build in the cycle part into it. So it's not just the food, but also seeing how that plays back and is relayed to you and what your cycle parameters are looking like.
We had one of our Gutsy members a couple years ago. She went through IVF and all the things. She couldn't get pregnant for years and years. And she joined the Gutsy Academy and completely overhauled her health and cut out like bad products and all the things, not ever thinking that food and nutrition were that important. Long story short, she overhauled her nutrition and her diet. And during the Gutsy Academy, she had her first period and was psyched about it. And then I think like 8 months later, after that, she fell pregnant. And the thing is, like, these things do matter. And signs and symptoms of, you know, like you're saying, like healthy menses is like, if it's not consistent, if you have high pain, like we shouldn't have painful periods. Mildly just uncomfortable, that's fine. Like when there's tons of pain and tons of inflammation, like there's hormonal imbalances there. And the quality of your food actually dictates the quality of your hormonal synchronicities and your hormones. And so I love that you said, like, what's the quality of your menses? Because that is going to be the foundation of how you go into your pregnancy. Is it true? I heard this from a different expert that you can often tell by how sick a woman gets in their first trimester. The sicker they are, the less healthy, I put that in air quotes, or the less functional their hormones were to begin with. And so the less nauseous they are, the healthier they were going into the pregnancy. Do you think that's true?
I think in some instances that can be true. Severity of nausea, I think, can be indicative of how healthy you were beforehand. Complete avoidance of nausea, I don't know that that's entirely possible, because it does seem to be almost like a normal response to all the hormonal adjustments that are happening in early pregnancy. And like histamine actually plays a pretty big role in nausea. low blood sugar levels, the way your insulin and blood sugar regulation systems are changing in the first trimester, that can play a role. Iodine status and thyroid health can play a role. In fact, women who have like issues with their thyroid, sometimes they have, if they're hypothyroid, they often don't have nausea, and that can actually be a sign the pregnancy like isn't viable. There's a higher miscarriage rate in those with hypothyroidism. So I don't know that it's like a necessarily a bad symptom, but I do think we can certainly lessen the severity by coming into pregnancy with like better nutrient stores. I would say like inflammation at bay, so you don't have quite as big of a histamine response. And also like liver and gallbladder health. It does seem like people who have more liver and gallbladder issues tend to have worse nausea. But I've also had like the healthiest possible people with excellent nutrient stores, like micronutrient panels to prove it. Like they're so healthy, they still have some of that nausea come up. Might not be like totally debilitating, but uncomfortable enough to notice.
So before getting pregnant, what kinds of foods should people be gravitating towards? Supplements, like things that they should really focus on and make sure that they're getting that most women going into pregnancy miss?
I would say two things to really keep an eye on: your protein intake and your micronutrient intake. And actually this, like, it hits, it's like two birds with one stone, sort of an answer. Protein intake is really vital for really the functioning of our entire body, but our hormone balance, our thyroid health, just like our body's ability to recover, maintaining lean body mass, just metabolic health as a whole. And protein is very important for stabilizing your blood sugar levels. So in the past, I think I had focused a lot more on carbs. Oh, everyone's eating too many carbs or too many refined carbs, but it's really what you're eating in place of it. And we really need to be eating a sufficient amount of protein to stabilize our blood sugar, insulin, and cortisol levels. And that pays off in dividends for your reproductive hormone balance as well. And then if you take it from the micronutrients standpoint, our most nutrient-dense foods tend to be the foods that are richest in protein. There's a couple exceptions, but for the most part, yes. And then add on your like leafy green vegetables and like high antioxidant foods. So whichever way you take it from, that, those would be two areas that I would really emphasize.
And so how much protein should women be focusing on?
Great question, because the RDA is set way too low. So the RDA, if you like calculate it out for a woman who weighs, say, about 150 pounds preconception, that's 55 grams of protein per day. And that's not enough to optimize your hormone balance, in my opinion. There's all sorts of protein researchers who have highlighted the shortcomings of the RDA. It's really set at a level to prevent overt protein deficiency, but is not necessarily set at an optimal intake level. So you see recommendations where they're recommending protein intake upwards of double what the RDA is, or even beyond. But at the very least, I would say somewhere in the like 1.2 to 1.5 grams per kilogram would be like a good minimum starting place for most women, versus the RDA is set at 0.8.
My math is terrible. So for someone that's 150 pounds, that would be around like 80 to 90.
80 to 90, 100 grams. I think for most women, aiming for about 100 grams is a really good ballpark. And then if you're more physically active, you need more protein to account for like muscle synthesis and all the tissue turnover and recovery. And then if you're struggling with weight and you'd benefit from losing a few pounds, emphasizing more protein just as a higher proportion of your diet tends to work a lot better for optimizing your metabolic efficiency. So your body actually burns more calories when you eat more protein. So you might want to aim higher, like 110, 120. But these are like body weight calculations as well. So, you know, if you have somebody who's like 5'1 and like 100 pounds, they're not going to need as much protein as a woman who's 5'9 or 5'11 and weightlifts.
So as far as supplementation goes, do you have a brand that you like? I know everyone's going to ask me that after the podcast. So like, if I don't ask in the podcast, I get tons of DMs where they're like, what was her favorite brand or her favorite product or something? So what's your favorite brand of prenatal or natal vitamin? Should people start taking it before falling pregnant?
Yes. Yes, you should take it before falling pregnant. I recommend two brands that I really like, and I think it just depends on your needs and maybe availability for your area. Fullwell is a really excellent brand that's founded and operated by a registered dietitian, one of the so-called good ones, who gets it and has a very long, detailed clinical background in like fertility and pregnancy space. So that's a really well-formulated one. For what it is priced really well for the quality also. So Fullwell is excellent. They also have a fish oil, and you kind of need the DHA as well. So I recommend both. Seeking Health is another really excellent company, also founded, operated by a healthcare practitioner, a naturopathic doctor. And that one's really good. And they have a couple different formats for their prenatal as well. So they have not only like the comprehensive full dose one, but they have like an essentials one. They have a powdered one that comes packaged with collagen, so you can add it to shakes. They have like a chewable one. So if you need like a different format, that's a good option to consider.
Think that with my own research, what was really important was also methylated B vitamins for people that, like, I feel like any female going into pregnancy and during pregnancy, you just need to make sure you're taking methylated B vitamins, right? Because that's so important for DNA and cellular replication and energy metabolism and function and like cellular health and healing and all the things. And so do you feel like prenatals have enough methylated B vitamins?
It depends on the brand. So both of the products I just mentioned do. They both use methylated forms. Seeking Health also has some that have like alternatives to the methylated forms. So they are biologically active, but not methylated for people who have issues with too many methyl groups. That's a thing. So those ones do. But like, people don't realize that there's no industry standard for what defines a prenatal. So you can have Joe Schmo company create a prenatal. It may be the equivalent of like off the shelf, one a day. There's no standards they have to follow for the nutrients they include, the form of the nutrients they're found in, the dosage of the nutrients, the quality control, whether they test for heavy metals or not, or contaminants, whether they actually test their batches to prove that it has the dosage that the label claims. Like, none of this is a requirement to market it as a prenatal. So it's like, it's a hot mess out there.
I had no idea. Like, that is shocking to me. This is like the future generations, right? Like, we want to make sure. And what really bugs me about that too is because we're not just needing these nutrients for building healthy humans, but for postpartum as well. Because if mom isn't getting enough nutrition in and all of her nutrients are going to baby, baby comes out and she's an empty vessel. And so that really bugs me that like there are not enough guidelines to protect women and their health and their bodies, as well as babies as well. So that's very, very frustrating.
I agree. It's absolutely shocking. So we really need to, ultimately, it's up to the consumer to just be well-informed, sadly, until there's some other guidance in place.
So obviously eating well, taking a really good prenatal, fish oil, all that stuff. Is there anything else that you can think of? Like, what I love taking is organ. So I will take like an organ complex, because I always say that's Mother Nature's multivitamin. And then I don't take it in my first trimester because of the vitamin A. And there's research behind that that says too much vitamin A can cause deformities in babies, but that's like extremely high forms of vitamin A. However, after the first trimester, you can go back on organ complexes. What are your feelings about organs?
I'm a huge fan of organ meats. I highlight them in all of my books and go to kind of great lengths to debunk the whole concern over vitamin A toxicity from them. That actually isn't proven specifically for organ meats. That all stems from research in the 1990s where they gave pregnant women high dose synthetic vitamin A supplements. And actually, not every study had the same results. So there were a handful of studies that had negative results. There were other studies where they didn't see birth defects until the vitamin A dosage was triple what some of the other studies have. My opinion on vitamin A is that our guidelines are set really, really, really conservatively. That said, I don't recommend liver is the one that you have to be concerned about for vitamin A. That's the one I don't recommend massive consumption of, and particularly during the first trimester. And so, but a dosage of 3 to 6 ounces of liver per week gets you nowhere close to the teratogenic birth defect level even though it's not a one-to-one to synthetic vitamin A, if we're going to use that as our benchmark, you're still safe to have 3 to 6 ounces of liver per week.
When I was doing blood chem analyses at Provo Health, I never saw a person with optimal vitamin A levels unless they had liver disease. And then they had an overabundance of vitamin A. So I really want to stress to women, like, vitamin A is really important. I know I'm like pushing my agenda a little bit, but I'm like, organs are really important for pregnancy. You know, like you said, maybe skip the first trimester. Taking a prenatal is really important. Making sure you're focusing on those B vitamins, minerals, right? What are your favorite minerals for women to focus on pre-pregnancy?
Could I throw in one other little factoid on vitamin A you'll probably appreciate?
Yes.
So everyone's concerned about excess vitamin A, but in the US, upwards of 80% of women don't even hit the very conservative RDA. So 80% are not even getting like bare minimum levels of vitamin A. And while we're concerned about excess and birth defects, and I'm like cautious of that as well, there are actually certain birth defects that can be caused by vitamin A deficiency. And those are happening at increasing rates. One of them is congenital diaphragmatic hernia. And that's happening in the last 30 years, there have been over 1 million cases.
Wow.
Whereas number of birth defects attributed to vitamin A excess in that same time period is fewer than 20 cases.
Oh my gosh.
And that's not even proven that it's vitamin A. So it's like extremely, exceedingly rare that you're going to have an issue with vitamin A excess, but vitamin A deficiency, I mean, the data we have linking congenital diaphragmatic hernia is not just animal studies. We have multiple lines of human studies finding that same association. So I think we need to be like, yes, cautious and not go crazy overboard, but also acknowledge the importance of vitamin A as well.
It almost makes you wonder, like, well, not even wonder, but it's like, of course, women don't feel good after their babies because they're so deficient in so many vitamins and minerals that, like, I always say our babies are like the most wonderful, lovable parasites on the planet. And they're the most enormous parasite ever because they're sucking us dry of all of our juices, right?
I mean, they are.
And then the baby pops out and our hormone cocktail ends and we're this empty vessel. And then we hear things like, don't take too much vitamin A. And so women will probably just avoid it. And so they're just depleting themselves and their babies. But again, baby is going to take whatever mom has. So even if mom has little stores, correct me if I'm wrong, but even if mom has very little stores, baby's taking all of them. So now mom has zero stores.
Yes. You will never end pregnancy more nutrient replete than you started pregnancy, right? You're always, always siphoning off from the bank account. You're broke. You're nutritionally broke by the time you have the baby. And then breastfeeding. I mean, speaking of vitamin A, like needs for vitamin A almost double when you're nursing. And that's not talked about either. You need the vitamin A for all of these changes to happen in your breasts to allow you to produce sufficient amounts of breast milk. People don't talk about that, but that's a requirement.
It's crazy because like I'm currently carrying my 2-month-old sleeping on my chest. And like, it makes me really frustrated that women are just left high and dry. You know what I mean? Like the babies come out, we're depleted, we're sleep deprived. You have to prep for postpartum before you get pregnant. Like my pregnancy was a surprise. And so I was like, oh crap, I wasn't planning for this, right? And I already knew I was going in deficient, right? And so I had a lot of catching up to do, but thank heavens I know what I know. And so I was like pounding all the supplements and taking my cocktails every day, you know, of like handfuls of supplements. But a lot of women don't know this. A lot of women are left in the dark, not given any kind of compass whatsoever. And really, like, if we want to prevent postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety, like all of these autoimmune dysfunctions that happen post baby, like we have to plan. If you're going on a shopping spree, you better make sure there's a lot of money in the bank account. And pregnancy is that shopping spree. And so you need to make sure you have a lot of vitamins and nutrition and minerals and macros and micros for this genetic, like for this miraculous biological shopping spree. And I'm putting there in air quotes, right?
Absolutely.
We have to just load up and make sure our bodies are filled with this stuff. And so are there any...
Do you want me to circle back to minerals?
Yes. I'm about to go back to minerals and be like, okay, what about minerals?
I had to go on a vitamin A tangent. Couldn't help myself.
I'm so glad you did.
There's so many vital minerals for both fertility, pregnancy, postpartum, breastfeeding. So some of the ones that can be especially depleted by all those sieges, iron and copper, both of which work hand in hand for red blood cell production. I mean, you're like a red blood cell producing factory. When you're pregnant, you have more blood in your system and you're also transferring so many nutrients to your baby. You're building their blood supply as well. So all of the nutrients involved in red blood cell production, but iron and copper being some really important ones, definitely tend to get depleted. Zinc is really vital. If you're hitting your mark for animal protein, especially, you're going to hit the mark for your iron, zinc, and copper. So you probably have no concerns there. Iodine would be another one I'd throw in the mix. Your iodine needs do increase during pregnancy and then further increase postpartum when you're nursing to accommodate all the changes that's happening with your thyroid, but also with your breasts as well. Everybody thinks about iodine being a thyroid nutrient, but your breasts actually concentrate more iodine than your thyroid does. And that affects your milk levels of iodine as well, which affects your baby's brain development. I mean, it's just wild how everything kind of snowballs. So those would be some minerals I definitely keep a close eye on.
Just to emphasize organs again, like organs have a really rich supply of copper and iron. And like the thing is, a lot of people aren't, and correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of people have iron deficiency, not because of low iron, but because of low copper, because copper actually enables your body to recycle iron. Iron is so important that your body has to recycle it. And copper is a cofactor of an enzyme that helps your body to recycle iron. So red blood cells die. There is parts of the carcass that are tossed out and your body excretes through feces, but the iron is recycled. Like it holds onto that iron because it's literally like the force of life, right? And so if you don't have that copper to recycle the iron, you will become iron depleted. And so organ complex, I had this incredible story of someone whose sister like was really low in iron, had to go to like an oncologist. They thought it was like cancer related. She saw my stories on organ complex and iron recycling and bringing up iron and whatnot. And so this girl, like this woman puts her sister on it, little sister, like she was a child. And so when she went back to the oncologist, all of her levels were normal again. And the oncologist was like, what did you do that was different? And they mentioned the organ. And like, he was completely convinced. He was like, this is amazing that these extremely, like extremely dangerous levels are now back to normal again. And so that's the power of copper.
And the other micronutrients that are in the liver there, because you also need like the vitamin A and the retinol form. You need B12, you need folate, you need glycine, you need riboflavin. So there's like this huge nutrient synergy happening within organ meats. And before we had isolated iron supplements or isolated B12 supplements, when they'd have a patient present with anemia in the 1940s, the treatment was liver or liver extract. Sometimes in the studies, it's called liver juice, which sounds like so unappealing, right? But that was the treatment. That was the default treatment for anemia because it isn't just an iron deficiency issue. I mean, we know anemia has more potential nutritional causes beyond iron, but still that tends to be the default that people resort to. So organ meats, especially liver, are my first choice when somebody is showing signs of anemia or their iron levels are looking a little off because it hits so many of those nutrients.
So basically, you guys, organ is literally Mother Nature's multivitamin. Like, don't turn your nose up at it. It is so, so good for you. In fact, sorry, putting a plug in for Just Ingredients, she came out with her own organ complex. So, and I know she sources the best of the best of the best. You don't want just any old cow's organs. You want like happy, clean cows eating grass fed lives, you know? So if you do Just Ingredients organ complex, I think I have a discount code. It's Gutsy Mom. Try that out. But definitely go for organ complex, guys. This was not a Just Ingredients plug, but I just want you guys to do organs so, so bad, because I just know how important it is. I feel like we could just do the whole hour on like getting your body ready for pregnancy. Is there anything else you want to add about minerals, or was that just it about with the organs?
We can keep going. There's all sorts of minerals that are vital. We didn't talk about like the electrolytes, for example. So I'll just give a little plug for electrolytes that when you're pregnant, your blood volume increases and you also have all this amniotic fluid, right? So there's more fluids in your system as a whole. And with that, you need more electrolytes to go along with them. Your body needs electrolytes at certain concentrations, and you'll start to have issues with fluid balance, either super dehydration or swelling. It can go in either direction when you're not getting enough electrolytes. So while people often feel like they need to avoid salt in pregnancy, maybe there's fears of high blood pressure or preeclampsia, they should know that actually the opposite has been shown to be true. Like, you actually need salt to prevent your blood pressure from going too high, because when your salt intake is too low, all these like compensatory hormonal systems kick in to conserve that salt, and that causes your blood pressure to go up. Whereas if you just consume more salt, assuming your kidneys are healthy, they maintain the appropriate balance and just excrete whatever is not needed. So sodium, potassium, magnesium, arguably calcium also has electrolyte functions. You would definitely want to get enough of all of those, particularly in pregnancy. And then I'll also add postpartum as well, because you're excreting so many fluids with your breast milk. And it's not like your baby's just getting pure water. Like, there's always going to be electrolytes with it. You think of, like, for the first 6 months of life, they're getting nothing but breast milk, or maybe like supplemental, like formula or supplemental breast milk, but they're not getting pure water because their bodies need those electrolytes. Just like when you have a sick kid, you know, you don't give them pure water. When you're dehydrated, you don't go to the hospital and get pure water. They give you, at the very least, a saline solution, right? Because you'll die if they give you too much water. You have to have the electrolytes with it. And I see a lot of women falling short on those.
That's actually a really beautiful segue into pregnancy and first trimester, because I find that a lot of women, they are nauseous because they don't have proper electrolytes. And when they start on something like Redmond or Superior or any kind, and you're welcome to mention your favorites if you want, but like, as soon as they start on minerals, it's a game changer. It's like their nausea literally goes away within seconds. Making sure you are properly hydrated just helps with all the functions, everything, proper amniotic fluid, because having too little amniotic fluid is really dangerous for baby, just all the things. Like you mentioned, postpartum, breastfeeding. Imagine the stress on, and again, I want to go back to postpartum depression and anxiety, like being depleted of magnesium and all of those electrolytes, like how awful that is for brain function. Your brain is literally an electrical circuit that needs vitamins and minerals, and it needs those electrolytes for proper neuro firing. And you are completely deficient. It's like a building without electricity. So of course, moms postpartum don't feel good because they're depleted, and now they're having their breast milk deplete them even more for a good cause. But like, let's be mindful that we need to put the electricity back in mom so she feels good again. Anything else during pregnancy, as far as, I feel like we've covered a lot, like pre-pregnancy that can revert over to pregnancy. As far as foods to focus on, you've mentioned protein, leafy greens. Are there any other foods that women during pregnancy should focus on, especially when they're nauseous? They don't have an appetite, or they have an aversion to meat or something. Like, how can they support themselves?
Obviously, the foods to emphasize when you're not feeling sick and having food aversions is probably going to be different than what you're going to eat when you're in survival mode of nausea and food aversions. So you have to make the best of it when you're confronted with the nausea and food aversions, and just do the best that you can. I do have sections in Real Food for Pregnancy going through nausea tips and tricks and what to do with food aversions and all of that. I can reassure you that for the majority of women, it is a phase, and it is a phase that usually only lasts usually like first trimester or maybe the first half of pregnancy, and then it eases up. And this gives you a little more plug to preconception nutrition, because if you have pretty good nutrient stores, if you've been working on that for a while, you can feel at peace that, okay, at least I came into this pretty prepared, and my body can, like, I have the nutrient stores to pull this off, and I'll get back to it when my symptoms improve. It just gives you a little bit of peace of mind. But when that phase is done, certainly the foods you already mentioned, eggs with the yolks are also a really fantastic nutrient-rich source, really rich in choline, which is very important for similar reasons to the nutrient folate. Meat, high protein foods. So you got like your meat, your poultry, especially like meat on the bone that is high in collagen. You do need more collagen when you're pregnant and also postpartum for recovery. So emphasizing those foods. Seafood, especially fatty fish. I would also throw in small shellfish in there, like oysters and clams. Those arguably have a lot of the similar nutrient density as organ meats. They're slightly different, but they are super rich in iron, zinc, copper, B12. They also have like more DHA than liver does. Like they're a really good addition. But fish in general for that omega-3 fat, if you're not consuming them, in fact, I would say like definitely you want to have a supplement on board, or if you're not consuming much of them, have a supplement on board. And then of course, like these aren't the only foods I recommend as a part of a full meal plan. I'm just kind of highlighting the ones that are particularly nutrient dense and like a good idea to include on a fairly regular basis.
And basically get the book. Like the book will be very, very enlightening. All three books, right? If you are pre and during and post. Beyond diet, what lifestyle and environmental factors should individuals be mindful of when it comes to pregnancy and just the whole like pre-pregnancy, fertility, during pregnancy and post?
A big one is paying attention to your toxin exposure. And of course, we're just inundated with toxins. So I like to focus on the ones that are within your control. And I do have like, there's full chapters on the toxin conversation if you want to really dive in, but just some brief points to keep in mind, like try to keep your plastic exposure as limited as possible. So trying to keep your food out of like plastic leftover containers and use glass instead. If you're reheating food, don't do it in plastic. If you can swap a plastic water bottle for a stainless steel, like those types of decisions are actually really helpful at reducing your toxin load. Choosing cleaner cosmetics that don't have parabens, artificial fragrances, or just a whole chemical soup of things that you don't even know what the ingredients mean. Just choosing cleaner products reduces our toxin load because you do absorb what's on your skin. And then another one would be thinking about what you're cooking your food in. So nonstick pans, for example, do transfer some of those, they're called perfluorinated chemicals, like from Teflon coatings, into your food. You actually ingest it. And that has not so great effects on your hormones and has been linked to a higher risk of certain pregnancy complications like preeclampsia. So swapping out those when you can for stainless steel, for cast iron, for glass bakeware, those are all really helpful. So definitely toxins. I know you want to cover a couple more topics, but I'll just throw in moving your body. Every time we move our body, we're like circulating our blood flow. We're moving lymph, which helps our body excrete toxins and such. We're sweating, which also is a way of removing toxins. So there's a sweet spot for exercise, both preconception and in pregnancy. You want to find a level that's right for you. It is totally possible to overdo it, but just listen to your body and try to have some type of movement, even if it's relatively light or moderate. Most days of the week for about 30 minutes is great. You can get into a little tricky territory with fertility if you're over-exercising and not fueling enough. A lot of athletes end up losing their cycle. It's called hypothalamic amenorrhea. And we cover that in Real Food for Fertility. So in those instances, like I said, there can be too much of a good thing. So whatever, like some activity is good, you may need to dial in the amount and the intensity and watch your menstrual cycle to see that it's working for you. In pregnancy, usually you get pretty immediate feedback if an exercise or activity feels good or not. And of course, adjust based on that.
I love that you added activity because I think when we fall pregnant, it can be easy, especially after the first trimester, I was like, you're done. You've been in bed for like months and you're like, how do I even become human again? I'm a slug. It's hard to get back into the swing of things. However, it's interesting. My first two pregnancies, I was in my 20s and I didn't exercise during those. And then now I was 30. I had Theo at 36 and I did exercise and I felt so good. Like my energy levels were so much better. I think he even came out healthier. You know what I mean? Like the hospital actually said that his liver enzyme levels were some of the best that they've ever seen, like the second best numbers that they've ever seen. And I don't think that was just from the exercising, but everything felt better. And I didn't overexercise. I didn't, and if I was tired that day, I wouldn't exercise, you know, because I'm like, my body's telling me it needs rest. But just getting some movement, it just helps to get blood flow going. It helps sweating. It just helps with all the things like that supports our bodies. And again, post-pregnancy, you know, like postnatal, having that muscle mass and that energy for recovery has been so important for me because having babies is like being hit by a car. You know what I mean? Like your body is just like, what happened? And I'm so grateful that I had the stamina and I had the muscle mass to get me through it. And then after the 6 weeks, it's like, okay, I actually still have energy, even though I'm sleep deprived. Like, I'm still energetic. I'm not exhausted and fatigued. Like, the mitochondrial function is still there and it's not rusty yet. And so I love all of those tips. One other thing to the chemicals, there's a lot of pots and pans that market themselves as green pans, and they have like a non-toxic, non-stick covering. They're still very toxic. Don't believe marketing. It's
totally deceptive marketing, because they'll market it as it might be lacking one PFC, right? They made a non-stick coating and it's like PFOA free. Okay. PFOA is a really problematic, highly researched perfluorinated chemical that is indeed an issue. But they could be using any other PFC and they've only highlighted one they're not using, right? And so I personally steer clear of any of these so-called like ceramic nonstick. I'm like, that's BS. It's not ceramic. It's full of PFCs. We don't know which ones. They don't disclose it. It's all proprietary. But I'm like, I stick to grandma pans. Okay. It's like stainless cast iron glass, like enameled cast iron for like a Dutch oven or something. But it's like, if your food sticks, scrub it off. You know, it's not worth the chemical exposure.
100%. Okay, so we've covered a lot of pre-pregnancy, which covers a lot of pregnancy, you know, and getting like, it's just all the same concepts, right? Like, I think of pregnancy as like running a marathon, and you have to train for the marathon, and like pre-pregnancy is training, and then the marathon is like pregnancy. And then like the marathon has ended and you're exhausted. Like, how do you take care of yourself afterwards, right? Because there's wear and tear that was had during your marathon run. Your body's hurting, your joints are aching, your glycogen stores are depleted, you know, like you're low in energy. Now what? So now baby has come, baby's healthy, mom is recovering. What should women be focusing on?
Yeah, I love talking about postpartum. It's so under-focused on in our culture. And I think like many moms, I was blindsided by it the first time around. I put so much effort into being so healthy. I was already like, my whole career had been devoted to prenatal nutrition. So that was all cared for. Birth was all planned out, right? And it's like, other than getting a couple meals in the freezer, I was like, oh. And thank God I had some friends who did a meal train for me, because otherwise it would have been really difficult. You can't predict, especially if it's your first baby, how little like energy, mental bandwidth, wherewithal you will have to put towards food preparation. Yet that is like, you need to be so heavily nourished postpartum that in our culture, sadly, because we're not in one of those cultures that has that built-in support system from friends and family members, you kind of have to put in some of the work up front on preparing for a nourished postpartum, whether that's freezer meals, choosing nutrient-dense recipes to outsource to friends and family to bring you, meal train, meal delivery service, postpartum doula, like family member coming to live with you. Like, you need to have helping hands on the ready, and more for just a week or two. Like, postpartum lasts a while. And in my opinion, it's like really a full 2 years for full recovery. But those first months and first couple months is really super, super vital to nourish yourself well. And you will probably be surprised at how much more food you need to eat, but you need a lot of food. You'll probably be really hungry.
I want you to repeat, it will take a couple years for your body to recover. One more time, because I want women to really hear this, because I run into so many women that are like, oh, I'm 6 months and or 1 year and I still haven't lost the weight. And it's like, we're not meant to bounce back. Your body has literally been engineered to sustain this life, not to be rocking a bikini, right? So please, can you talk a little bit more about that journey of 2 years, what women will be experiencing? I also want to really hit before we go into that, like, you got pregnant. You had a hormone cocktail that actually decreased your immune response, because your body does that so that your body doesn't attack baby. Because if our bodies attack baby, we would all miscarry and then our human species would be no more. Like, that's why so many women that have autoimmune diseases, they get pregnant. They're like, I feel amazing, right? Because the dimmer switch went down on your immune response. And now baby pops out and that dimmer switch revs up. And not only does it rev up, your body then sees it's nutrient depleted, mineral depleted, protein depleted. Like, it sees there's so much missing and goes into like inflammatory cascades. And so this is why it's so important to recognize that that immune response, and Lily, correct me if I'm wrong, but that immune response may potentially happen. There's ways to prevent it. Like you said, like loading up on nutrition, right? Like having a bank account loaded with vitamins and minerals and all that. But that, like, asking people for help so that you're resting a lot. You're not supposed to bounce back. Like, I'm 2 months and I'm overwhelmed and tired and I have people helping me, right? Like, I literally just called Gina, who's my, like I mentioned earlier, my co-host. And I said, can you help me in the evenings this week? I am overwhelmed and I'm mentally struggling because I'm overstimulated, right? My body's still healing. I'm breastfeeding a baby. I'm often the last one to eat because I have 4 children that I'm feeding right now. You know, like, these are hard times. And we also have our immune system working against us. And we also are nutrient depleted and sleep deprived and all of these things. Can you just please lay it out for us and just paint us this picture of what it can look like and what we need to be doing and why we need to be gentle during this time?
Yeah, well, I think we first need to acknowledge that other cultures have a built-in time period of like extreme rest for mothers. It's usually 40 days. Sometimes 41, depends on the culture you're looking at, but it's very consistent globally. We've totally lost sight of that in the West, but there was often a time where like an older family member would come to your house and prepare meals for you, or you might live with her and you'd have this support. So all you had to do was rest and recover and receive support. There was somebody literally cooking all the meals for you or heating up the food and bringing it to you, holding the baby so you can take your one shower every couple of days or whatever. There was that support aspect built in, because especially the first week and first 2 weeks, I feel like you feel like a whole new woman at week one and a whole new woman again at week two. And then you kind of hit your stride a little bit. Like after the first month, you feel maybe like a little more together. I mean, you're usually not, because postpartum, like you have a wound the size of a dinner plate in your uterus where the placenta was attached and that needs to heal. And in that time, you have lochia, which is like a period basically, but often prolonged, a little different than a regular period where you're bleeding. And during that time when you're bleeding, that corresponded with that 40 days of rest. It varies woman to woman, but that initial, especially that first month to 6 weeks is the time really to rest. And you really have to go by how you're feeling day to day, whether or not you even want to get out of bed. Like you want to just really stay in bed as much as you can, especially that first week, and very slowly ease back into so-called normal life. In that time, we really need to focus on replenishment. And postpartum nutrition is significantly understudied in humans. We have more data on postpartum recovery for farm animals than we do for humans.
Oh my God.
From that data, we know that nutrient requirements go through the roof. I've heard from some farmers that their animals will consume double, triple, quadruple, quintuple the amount of food in that early recovery time. And so you need to lean into that. And specifically, not just calories, but specifically those nutrient-dense foods that are going to rebuild your nutrient stores. And also specifically, protein. So we actually, as of a few years ago, we have our first ever study on protein requirements postpartum. They looked at women who were 3 to 6 months postpartum and exclusively breastfeeding. They needed more protein than a typical female athlete.
Oh my God.
All they're doing is breastfeeding.
No wonder we feel terrible, right? No wonder we're like, oh, there's no hormones here. There's no this. There's like, why am I not recovering? Why don't I have energy? Like, that's insane to me.
You need to be aiming upwards of probably minimum of like 25% more protein than you were even consuming at the end of pregnancy. And no harm if you feel like more, like go for it. Go hog wild on the protein. That is really what's going to help satiate your appetite when you feel completely ravenous with nursing, right? When you're nursing and you use the term sucked dry, it feels like that. It feels like your energy is being sucked out of you, because it is, but it also tanks your blood sugar too. And so that protein, not that I'm like anti other food sources or anything, but that protein really helps to stabilize your blood sugar levels and satiate you for longer, so that you're not so ravenously like emergency running to the pantry after you finally get baby down for a nap. And like, of course, most of the things in our pantry are just carbs. they don't satiate you for very long. You're hungry again in like 30 minutes. And you're like, so that's really where we need to focus, is on those nutrient dense foods. And of course, that requires prep and help from other people. So this is the time to bust out the slow cooker for stews, pulled pork, pot roast, chili, like really like nourishing protein dense kind of meals. And then get other people to help make food for you if at all possible. And if that's not available to you, ordering in outside food, meal delivery service, pre-made rotisserie chicken from the grocery store, like something to really fill that protein void.
I live on DoorDash right now.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. Like, I think I DoorDashed twice yesterday and they were both aubergine.
Nice.
So like, I'm sure aubergine, like they're like, oh yeah, Shanique's ordering her salmon salad again, like, just like she did yesterday and the day before and the day before. So like, thank heaven for DoorDash, but it can be pricey. And so I love that you mentioned like those meals that you can, like they deliver to you and you put them in your freezer. There's one company called like Beehive Meals that I've used that have, you know, it's got a lot of protein in it. Just grabbing some extra veggies here and there, making smoothies throughout the day and having those meals can be really, really helpful.
Really helpful.
Any last tidbits for postpartum women taking care of themselves that they need to be mindful? Obviously, still taking your prenatal vitamins, taking Organ. I found for me personally, taking my placenta, I had placenta encapsulation. I don't know if you have opinions on that. I know a lot of women will love to pick your brain on that. Do you have an opinion? It helped me mentally just because my midwives are like, it has hormone in it that can, like, when you are hormone empty, like it can just like lift you up a little bit. I found like my, like I would go into anxiety and then I would take my placenta and I'm like, okay, my brain's back online again. You know, do you have opinions on placenta encapsulation?
It's super mixed woman to woman, their experience with it. So I don't think it's, you know, harmful to have it on hand if you want to do that. There actually have been some studies looking at iron intake from placenta, encapsulated placenta at a typical like traditional Chinese medicine dosage, it actually can provide up to like a quarter of your iron needs for the day, which is kind of interesting. There's also very mixed opinions out there on it though, because some people in the lactation space feel that if you're taking the placenta over a long period of time, technically you're introducing like progesterone and those pregnancy hormones. And some people say they notice a difference in their supply. So I think you just kind of have to go with it, whatever you want to do. I do also think there's a really strong, to go back to the organ meats, a really strong emphasis to be made for organ meats, because technically when you look at the placenta, in both in how it looks visually, but also in many of its functions, it's kind of like a temporary liver and an interface between mom and baby. And so I think in terms of like, certainly you're not going to have the hormones that you have from the placenta, but nutrient-wise, probably going to have pretty similar micronutrient levels to what you'd get from liver. So if you don't want to do placenta or whatever, certainly emphasizing those organ meats is a great idea. And a lot of cultures actually do that. Specifically, organ meats are included in postpartum recovery period.
I love that you mentioned postpartum do organ meats. A lot of women have asked me, because I've shared about placenta encapsulation and that I was doing it and how I felt better. They're like, well, isn't it a filtering organ? Like, doesn't it filter all the toxins? And so I want people to understand this. If it filtered and held onto toxins, it would be a toxic organ and would make you and baby very sick and you would die. The same thing with the liver. If the liver held onto all the toxins and was a basket full of toxins, you would become very sick, ill, and die. So it is a filtration organ, but then it dumps it somewhere. It's kind of like having a trash can in your house, but then you take the trash bags out to the trash outside and then someone comes and picks it up. It's the exact same process. So don't be scared if you're like, I want to do a placenta encapsulation, but I'm scared that, like, I've heard that it just holds on to toxins. It can't do that, right? You literally become ill.
There have been some of the studies looking at placenta encapsulation on toxin levels, and they're not abnormally high. So I have the same opinion on organ meats as well. It's funny how people will nitpick certain specific things. They're like, oh, I can't have that. It's toxic. I'm like, okay, I mean, pick your poison, because literally you can pick on every single food out there and point out, oh no, that's toxic for this reason, that reason, whatever. And you have to take it in consideration to what is the benefit of a particular thing. So like, Yes, that I agree with you that yes, it's a filter, not necessarily a storage organ.
And I'm so glad that you mentioned that because I feel like it's very trendy these days for influencers to take one research article with small amount of subjects and then highlight and be like, look how dangerous this is. And I'm like, this was one study with 20 people, right? You can't make this like golden plates, you know, like important. So I'm glad that you mentioned that people tend to highlight certain things and we can get upset about anything. You can literally find like paper is carcinogenic, so don't ingest it. Research study out there, you know what I mean? And be like, don't touch paper or ingest it. Anyways, I know we're running out of time. How can people find your book if they want more information? What other resources do you have out there?
I have a ton of resources actually, and many of them are on my website. So lilynicholsrdn.com. You can download the first chapter of Real Food for Pregnancy for free if you want to get like sort of insight into what I'm even talking about with real food. But I think a really interesting part of that download that people love is there's a micronutrient comparison between a conventional meal plan following the guidelines versus one of mine. And you can see in black and white why quality of food you're consuming and nutrient density makes such a difference. On my site, you can find all my books. There's a tab for that. You can find my blog. There's tons of articles up there, hundreds and hundreds. So postpartum recovery, there's a whole blog article on postpartum recovery, links out to like 50 plus recipes. So you have the recipes to either pre-prep for your freezer or give to family members to make for you. That's definitely a helpful resource. And then, yeah, as far as social media, I'm most active these days on Instagram. And my handle is the same as my site. So Lily Nichols, RDN.
Awesome. Lily, this was an incredible interview. Thank you for your expertise, your research, like backing it all by science and really mentioning all the research out there and keeping us up to date. I really appreciate your time and your dedication to this area of the world where women are not really supported during postpartum and during pregnancy. So thank you again. And listeners, definitely give her a follow, get her books. Clearly, Lily knows what she's talking about and has done the research and just wants to help women have successful pregnancies. So anyways, we'll catch you next week. Take care, listeners. Thank you for listening to the Gutsy Health Podcast. We hope you enjoyed and learned a lot from this episode. For more updates, follow us on Instagram @GutsyHealthPodcast.